Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Love that theme. Hello once again, and welcome back to the Box Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Dr. Paul Lemansky joins us today to respond to your questions and comments. A urologist was supposed to be on today, Paul. I don't want to insult you in any way because you were here last week and we love you. And then I called Paul and he said, I'll do it. And I thank you so much, Paul. The urologist called at the last minute and said he couldn't come. So that's right. What's another name for a urologist? Anyway, Paul's practices the Capital Care Center for Preventative Medicine. The Capital Care Center for Preventative Medicine, and it is at 501 New Carner Road, Albany, New York, and the phone is 518-640-3260. Dr. Lemansky is a renowned board-certified internist with a master's degree in human nutrition. He's a graduate of New York Medical College. Prior to his work at the Center for Preventative Medicine, Dr. Lemansky was clinical chief for cardiovascular health care for Kaiser Permanente's Northeast Division. He's assistant professor of medicine at Albany Medical College. Paul Lemansky, it's always wonderful for you to be here. Just this morning, Paul, I'm so glad you're here, because just this morning, yet another report came out that exercise is not the way to lose weight. Now, I, for all of these years, 25, 30 years, I've never missed a day. I do it every day for an hour. Intensive exercise of one kind or another, aerobic exercise. Now I hear, but I always knew. I always knew that it doesn't allow you to lose weight. The only thing that loses weight is what you eat.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much true. And thank you, Alan. I enjoy being here. I've said for quite a while now, maybe it's about 8 or 9 years, that weight loss requires caloric restriction. That said, there are some individuals who want to use exercise to lose weight. And it is possible, Alan. However, it has to be done in conjunction with caloric. You have to hold your calories constant. So in other words, if all you do is increase your exercise, you have to exercise a tremendous amount in order, and it's very hard to do, in order to lose weight. However, if you truly wanted to do it that way, you could become aware of what your caloric intake was, maintain that caloric intake, and then on top of that, increase your activity level. Now, folks say to me, well, if that's the case, well, why exercise at all? Because exercise is the premier way for maintaining weight. So caloric restriction, and as I've said, to a lesser extent, exercise while holding calories constant will lose weight. And then weight maintenance is done through exercise.
But isn't it also true that when we exercise, it's good for the rest of us?
Oh, absolutely.
Like the heart and everything else.
Absolutely. Yeah. Heart, the brain.
Yeah.
Okay, so you'll find that after you exercise for a few days, your mood will improve.
No question.
After a few weeks, you will be in a much better mental place. So there are studies on showing that antidepressants, while they work, are augmented in their ability to improve our depression levels if one exercises in addition. So we always recommend exercise. Look, human beings, when our biology and our biochemistry was becoming adapted to our environment, had to exercise because that was our major form of transportation,
yeah,
walking.
Or as the 2,000-year-old man put it, fear.
Yes.
You were running away from a saber-toothed cut.
Yes, well, yeah. But a lot of times you were just walking to gather, you know, root vegetables and, you know.
Nuts.
So these kind of things, what we were adapted to 150,000 years ago, are what determined what our biochemistry is today. And therefore, since our ancestors exercised, we have to exercise in order to maintain the human machine in the proper condition. Now, if everybody doesn't exercise, and, you know, after another 150,000 years, maybe people won't have to exercise. But right now, we're dealing with a machine, the human machine, that's 150,000 years old, and that requires exercise in order to be optimally fit and optimally functional.
You don't mind if I ask what exercise you do, do you?
I walk. Now, actually, just today, I've never tweeted before, but today was my first tweet to let folks know that I was in my new office at Capital Care on New Corner Road, and then to say that my Fitbit had established me as having so many steps by, I don't know what, it was 9 o'clock this morning, I had 1,500 steps or thereabouts.
Well, you teach major classes in all of this, and I'm always fascinated to see people looking at you adoringly when I pass by. But I wanted to ask you about a lady who called last week who said he doesn't know what he's talking about, because the American College has now said you can have all the heavy cream and stuff that you want, and I have always practiced just the opposite. So what's the story here?
Well, I don't know. I haven't heard what that particular...
Well, wasn't there a study that came out that they had changed their guidelines, that the NIH or somebody had changed their guidelines so that...
Well, not really. I mean, there has been some recognition that fat is not a horrible thing, but, you know, we never said it was. At least those of us in the nutrition field had never said you need fat. You need essential fatty acids to survive. Excuse me. The thing that is still true is that saturated fat, while in excess, and again, we have to emphasize that all of this is in excess. Whenever fat is eaten in excess, that and not part of a balanced intake of proteins and carbohydrates as well as the fats, you're going to get adverse events occurring as a consequence. Fats are very, you know, calorically dense. You eat too much fat, generally speaking. If you don't increase your activity level, you're going to put on weight. You put on weight, suddenly you are introducing all sorts of problems for the body with regard to maintaining normal function. So while fat is not perhaps, you know, in the old days, we hammered on the drum that fat was bad to the extent where people went to carbohydrate, only to find out that carbohydrate is by itself, if you consume excess carbohydrate, is no better than consuming excess fat. It all ends up contributing to problems. What we need to strike is a balance.
Well, what about all them vegetarians who have stewed greens for dinner every night and don't do protein?
I think that's wonderful.
Well, what about the protein?
Well, they get their proteins from legumes, you know,
and mix protein them with the rice. You mean
protein complementarity? You know, rice and beans. Yeah. You know,
what are the carbs we don't like?
Sugar. That's we don't like sugar.
No, sugar. Nobody should eat sugar.
Right. Because why? It doesn't exist in nature.
Uh-huh.
Not really. I mean, you can have sugar in fruits. But again, if you think about this, what percentage of the year are fruits available? Even seasonally here, locally, you're going to have for a very short period of time. As a consequence, the human machine did not become adapted to fructose, all year long in large amounts. Didn't. Yeah. So, you know, when the recommendation is to eat, you know, fruits and vegetables.
5 servings a day.
Right. Or even up to 9 now. We're not saying 8 servings of fruit and 1 of vegetables. I like to flip it around and say, well, we're really saying 8 servings of vegetable and 1 of fruit.
Yeah.
So the idea here is your body was not adapted to eating a lot of fruit because it just wasn't available in the environment. So consequently, you shouldn't do that. You should do what is more reasonable, which is to eat vegetables predominantly and some meat, some fish, some fruit.
Now, the Weight Watchers says you can't, and I have to go now to take a break, but the Weight Watchers says that fruit is only 1 point, or is no points now, to eat a piece of fruit. I find that hard to believe, but I find
Well, you know, they're trying to incentivize
to eat
fruit
them.
Because people don't eat it.
Yeah, I got it.
Okay. So, you know, but I mean, if we were to look at it as someone with a reasonably balanced diet, we wouldn't be pushing fruit. Again, the body does not do well with that kind of sugar. Fructose is sugar.
Okay. We'll take a short break, and then we'll be back.
Support comes from Nathan Latour Hospital, welcoming Dr. Alvarez, a gastroenterologist specializing in diseases of the digestive system, practicing in their new gastroenterology center in Johnstown, New York, accepting new patients, NLH.org. Curran Compliance Services, Greenwich, New York, and now in St. Paul, Minnesota, national compliance and regulatory consultants for the life insurance industry, CurranCompliance.com. The Linda, WAMC's Performing Arts Studio, presenting Garland Jeffries Saturday, June 27th at 8 p.m., thelinda.org. Lucky Chocolates, Saugerties, New York, offering a cafe with a seasonally changing menu including local produce and organic ingredients, luckychocolates.com. And from Harrington's Lumber, Millwork, and Building Supplies, offering painting advice and Regal Select Exterior Revive finishes from Benjamin Moore, formulated for vinyl siding, Harrington's.com.
And we are back with the wonderful Dr. Paul Lemanski, one of my great friends and a hero to me. He's at the Capital Care Medical Group, the Center for Preventative Medicine. Get ahead of it. 518-640-3260. And let's go to Jim from Matamoros. Very quickly, Jim. Welcome back. Go ahead, Jim.
Streptococcus mutans has been associated with endocarditis. Are there any other genus and species commonly associated with heart disease?
Well, all bacteria, if they get in the bloodstream, S. mutans is going to be coming from your gums and teeth, So if bacteria get into your bloodstream, and then on top of that you have a structural abnormality in the heart, then you can get endocarditis. But, this presupposes a structural abnormality. You can't just get it easily on a normal heart valve.
Okay, Jim, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Let's go to Ron in Colony. Ron, you're on.
Yes, hi, Alan. Hi, Doc.
Hello.
I don't know whether you said this or not, Alan, because I didn't quite catch what you said about the fats.
Yeah.
But Dr. David Perlmutter, who wrote Grain Brain, he was saying, I listened to about 2.5 hours of him yesterday, and he actually wants you eating 70% fat and then 30% the rest of your diet. And, of course, we're talking good fats, avocados, nuts, seeds, olives, olive oil, that type of thing.
Right.
Basically, then you go into ketosis, and, your energy is being, you teach your body to start, burning fat.
So, David, Ron, there's nothing new here. I mean, we know about Atkins and all of those years that...
But it's a little bit different than Atkins.
Well, everything's a little bit different.
Well, he flips it around. Instead of saying he wants you
to... He wants you eating no grains.
Yeah, I mean, that's right, because if you're eating 70% fat and you're eating some protein, then the remainder is going to be almost no carbohydrate. It really is
good carbohydrates.
What's that?
Good carbohydrates. Your vegetables, berries...
Good. I think if he's pushing this for the brain, it's because the brain basically is made of fat, right? I mean, it's got the insulator for the wires up there, if you will. The neurons considered wires, and the insulation is, sphingomyelin, which is a fat. I mean, these are the kind of things that neurologists like to talk about. But, while that... I don't know of any data on that in terms of eating that high-fat diet contributing to improvement in mental function in normal individuals. I do know that if you eat it too high of fat, even if it's good fat, it's not necessarily going to have a good effect on serum lipids and your heart arteries and the other arteries in your body. So one would have to, if they were going to experiment with this kind of an approach, have a lipid profile done before going on it and then subsequently on it. And if their lipids didn't worsen or if they improved somewhat, then I think that would be a good thing.
The lipids being what?
Cholesterol, HDL, LDL, triglycerides.
His father had Alzheimer's, and that's how he actually, because he's a neurologist.
Yeah, I don't know of any data that that diet's going to affect Alzheimer's disease, to be perfectly honest.
Although they do tell you.
Well, it's not easy, that's for sure.
They do tell you about the Alzheimer's, that exercise is the one thing that seems to be a little bit helpful. I don't know.
Well, there are things associated with decreasing dementia. Whether that is truly causally related or not has yet to be determined. But, yeah, I mean, look, people who not just exercise, but use their brains are going to have less. But yes, exercise itself has been associated with lower incidence of Alzheimer's.
Ron, you've heard it from the doctor.
Thank you very much. I like this doctor because he's got a very...
open.
He's got a different approach of knowing a little bit about everything.
Well, that's true, and I'll tell you what my response would be. Don't do it. Thanks, Ron.
Oh, I do it already. That's no problem.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, and here comes Ernesto. Okay, Ernesto, you're on.
Hello, doctors. I have a question about the coronary artery calcium scoring.
Right.
What you can tell me about it, is it worth getting, and what's it going to tell me?
Well, how old are you?
58.
Okay. So
cholesterol's just a little on the high side.
Right. So you know, a calcium score, basically what calcium are we talking about? Well, when atherosclerosis occurs in the heart arteries, LDL, the bad cholesterol, becomes deposited in the walls of the arteries, not supposed to be there. It sets up an inflammatory response in the artery. And in any part of the body that has chronic inflammatory condition, calcium gets deposited. This is true of, you know, tendons that are chronically inflamed. You can get calcific tendinitis. You know, many different processes in the body result in calcium deposition. That calcium can be seen by a CAT scanner. So we're talking about not just an X-ray, but a CT scan of the heart.
Right.
And there are ways of seeing and quantitating the amount of calcium and comparing it with the general population. So someone who's 58 is in all likelihood going to have some calcium in their heart arteries. But, you know, the level, if it's 2, 3, 4, 5 times what the average person would have, would be indicative of a fair amount of plaque in your coronary arteries. We treat elevated calcium scores, that is, anything over 0 really is elevated, shows you have plaque. If you have plaque in your coronary arteries, that plaque increases the probability of a heart attack, and the more plaque you have, the greater the probability. So those are the individuals that are treated aggressively with cholesterol lowering, both with diet, exercise, and with medications, like a statin, for example. Okay,
right.
So the idea here would be, if your calcium score were above 0 in a 50-year-old person, that you may decide to go on a statin where perhaps you don't want to take medicine otherwise.
Right.
So let's say your LDL cholesterol was 130. That's not particularly elevated.
Right.
The national guidelines say it has to be over 190 in order to start a statin without any other testing being done. But if you got a calcium score and that calcium score showed, a significant amount of plaque, you'd be probably make a good decision by at least attempting to go on one of the statins and continue to trying, if you had a problem with one, trying another, et cetera, until as a means of getting your cholesterol down in a way that's been proven in clinical trials to reduce not just the cholesterol, but also events, heart attacks and strokes. So in a sense, the calcium score thereby becomes another tool for determining whether someone should or shouldn't take medication. Now, I would say that, again, this is an X-ray test, that if you had a woman in her 50s or 60s and she wanted to know, do I have heart disease, do I have plaque in my arteries, I would, if she had a family history of heart disease, I probably would not do a calcium score and just treat her on the basis of family history of heart disease, especially if it were premature heart disease, because the X-rays will increase the risk of breast cancer. We don't know how much, but they would. To some extent, there's no lower level of ionizing radiation that's completely safe. So, you know, how would you use this? You'd use it judiciously and only when you couldn't get at the information any other way.
Okay, gotcha. Got to let you go. Ernesto, thanks
for calling. All right, thanks so much.
Appreciate it.
Yep.
All right. I got an email right here, Doc, that says a recent... Oh, let's see if I can read this right. A recent spate of newspaper articles. No, okay, I'm making this up. A recent spate of newspaper articles showed that people who had been taking Prilosec or other proton pump inhibitors, is that what they are? Yeah.
Yep, proton pump inhibitors.
Are more likely to have heart attacks. What do you make of that?
I haven't seen that data. I don't know.
Oh, okay. All right, very good. Let's go to Shirley in Amherst. Okay, Shirley. 1-800-348-2551. You're on, Shirley. Hello, Shirley.
Guess we lost Shirley.
What happens is some people call. They think they're online. So they wash their hands, they go to the bathroom, or do things like that. And then finally, they come back to the phone. Shirley, counting 1, 2.
Yes. Oh, yes. Hello?
Are you there? Oh, good.
Yes.
You walked away from the phone and broke the rules, didn't you?
No, I just turned on the radio so I could hear. Okay.
No, you can't have the radio on.
Well,
you gotta...
no, that I heard my name and then I turned it off.
All right. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Yes, I want to tell him that aluminate, which is what it's called, this type of aluminum, destroys our brain and contributes to mental retardation in children when the women are eating the food with aluminum. There's something called aluminate in different kinds of salt. And aluminum in food. And if people cook acid foods in aluminum pans, it takes a bit of the aluminum out of the pan. It just breaks down to some degree. And people need to know that because and also contributes to the Alzheimer's.
Okay, now wait. Shirley, you've made your point. We had a spate of these reports years ago, Paul Lemansky. Is there anything to them?
Well, she is correct that aluminum toxicity can cause dementia. This was originally seen in dialysis patients. So, I'm not sure, about cooking in aluminum pots with acidic, I'm not aware of specific contraindications to the use of aluminum pots,
I learned a long time ago that the acid foods break down.
Who'd you learn it from?
Huh?
Who'd you learn it from?
I don't know. I started learning about nutrition and everything when I was 14, 60 years ago.
Yeah.
So
okay.
I don't remember.
Okay.
But it is true that that aluminum consumed in the diet can increase the risk for dementia. Normally if you use a pot, Alan, if you are cooking something over a few minute period, I don't think the amount of exposure is going to be significant. If you were cooking it over an extended period, perhaps,
But years of doing that.
Yeah.
No. Yeah.
And also, if you were making tomato sauce over, many hours, perhaps. But I would have to visit that again
or many years.
And do a clinical, do an assessment of, the data on that to be able to really comment.
Shirley, thank you. Next time, stay on the phone. Goodbye.
Okay.
Okay. Let's go to Susan in Malta. Susan, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Lemansky. Hi, Alan. Just a quick clarification on coconut oil. There's still an awful lot of recommendations that coconut oil is good for us. Can you help me?
What I would ask you is compared to what? So if you compare it to lard, absolutely, it's superior to lard. If you compare it to olive oil, I don't think so. Coconut oil is a saturated fat. Saturated fats elevate LDL cholesterol. Somehow people have gotten the notion into their heads that if you're in a South Sea Islander and you climb a tree to get your coconut, that they don't have any heart disease, so why wouldn't it be, you know, secondary to the consumption of coconut oil, and why couldn't we all do it and get their outcome without having to climb a tree? Well, I think that, you know, they select out that population because they can climb a tree.
I was just going to say.
I think the composition of the diet really means less when you get sufficient exercise and maintain a normal body weight, except in the rare individual that has a genetic abnormality. In Western cultures, however, you know, we are more susceptible to the composition of the diet simply because we don't maintain a normal body weight and we don't exercise. And as a consequence, the composition becomes more important. Under those circumstances, I don't believe the consumption of coconut oil will be helpful to either your cholesterol or coronary artery disease prevention.
Susan, thank you.
That helps. Thank you very much.
Right. We'll go to Doug in Sheffield. Doug, you're on.
Hey, Alan. I must have misheard this earlier on in the program, that exercise does not play a great role in weight loss. So my brain says, okay, the guy who goes out and runs a marathon comes home and has a hamburger. The guy who sits in the office all day doesn't lift a finger other than to turn his car key and come home as a hamburger. They're going to gain weight equally?
Well, why should that be?
They're not going to get. That's what you said earlier on the broadcast.
No, that's not what he said.
I was reporting on an article in the New York Times.
Yeah.
And okay. Well, you know what? I was actually out chainsawing when I heard this. I didn't get it all right.
No, Doug, I was in fact reporting.
You should have been chopping that tree down, not sawing it down with a chainsaw.
Look
with
up.
An axe.
There's a lot of work involved with that, my friend.
Look up today's upshot in the New York Times,
right.
And it tells you the whole
no,
story.
No, but you're correct. What we were saying is that for the average person, okay, who does not exercise a lot, who does the exercise, you'd have to do a tremendous amount of exercise in order to lose weight. So there are individuals, for example, that run 5 miles a day. Generally, those people can eat what the heck they want, and they don't gain weight. On the other hand, most of us don't run 5 miles a day. Consequently, you know, the easiest and most focused way for the average person to lose weight is caloric restriction. It can be accomplished with exercise for the average person. However, what you would have to do, since you're not running 5 miles a day, is to do 1 or 2 mile walks a day, or maybe 3 or 4 mile walks a day, and hold where you weren't doing it before, and hold your caloric intake constant.
Mm.
So can exercise contribute to weight loss? Yes, it can, but it has to be done along with holding the caloric intake constant.
You know, I think I have another solution, whatever it's worth. If you go to work every day, and you don't have a big refrigerator, and people aren't bringing food in all of the time, you're basically okay because you're not tempted. But if you're at home and you're close to the refrigerator, you're screwed.
That's
you know
right.
what I mean? Well, you just eat too much.
Much more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I had to get that straight now because it doesn't seem to make sense to me.
It makes sense to me. I exercise every day, Doug. Every day for hour. It doesn't help me.
You know, you and I'm 5'10 and 140, and you're 5'7 and 130.
How about 5'5?
Really? You're shrinking.
Yes, I am shrinking. There's no question about it. That's what happens in life.
All right, but I'm just saying, I can't gain weight, and I eat a ton, but I also exercise a ton.
How old are you?
68.
Oh. Well, there's something wrong with you.
Yes, it's called you're not typical.
Too much chainsawing. I think it's genetics, personally. But
it could be.
You're absolutely correct. There are going to be, you know, there are different body types, you know, endomorphs, ectomorphs, mesomorphs.
So there's more to it than just not exercising, not eating. There's a lot more things involved.
Okay. We are talking.
That's why I want to get clear. That's what I called about.
Correct. Okay. Yeah. Okay. We are talking in general.
Thanks, Doug. Appreciate it.
Right. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to take a short break. And then we'll be right back as we round the horn.
Thank you.
support comes from Ellis Medicine, providing comprehensive inpatient and outpatient health care in Schenectady and Southern Saratoga counties. EllisMedicine.org. Rhinebeck Artist Shops, professional picture framing and fine art materials. Rhinebeck, New Paltz, and now at 793 Broadway in Kingston. RhinebeckArt.com. Curtis Lumber, working to support their communities through their Pet Connection sponsorship and by providing professional services and supplies to owners and contractors. CurtisLumber.com. Tierra Farm Retail Stores, Madison Avenue, Albany, and Route 203, Vallejo, New York. Organic nuts, dried fruit, fair trade coffee, chocolate, granola, nut butters, and gift baskets. TierraFarm.com. And from Columbia County, presenting concerts, dance, and theater performances this summer. ColumbiaCountyTourism.org.
And here we are back with my friend and wonderful friend indeed, Paul Lemanski of the Capital Care Medical Group, the Center for Preventative Medicine on New Corner Road in Albany, New York. Okay, I'm going to give the phone number only once because I know everybody calls me afterwards and I don't want to be bothered. 518-640-3260 for Paul Lemanski's practice, 518-640-3260. Okay, now with that in mind, we will go to, what does that say? A Lauren? Karen.
Karen,
okay. Karen in Skodak. All right, Karen in Skodak, this is your
Hello,
chance.
Hello, doctors. Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was glad you brought up the issue of calcium deposition on the coronary arteries.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know if you have an opinion as to the effect of taking calcium supplements on that process, because, you know, of course, women are, you know, told they must do that their whole lives to prevent osteoporosis.
Right.
And I had a calcium score, which, you know, was a little problematic.
Right. So, you know, first of all, the calcium that gets deposited in the artery walls comes out of a normal serum calcium level, okay? A normal serum calcium level. So, in other words, you know, we're drawing on a pool of calcium that's normal. If you take calcium supplements, you generally are not going to increase the calcium in your bloodstream. That can be dangerous, actually, okay? So doctors will always, you know, check the calcium in your bloodstream. The use of a supplement, as long as that supplement is in a reasonable range, 1,200 milligrams of elemental calcium a day, you're not, for most individuals now, for most individuals are not, and women, are not going to elevate their serum calcium in that way. They're going to be getting an adequate amount of calcium. That does not contribute to calcification of the arteries. What contributes to calcification of the arteries is the types of things that we talk about all the time: high cholesterol, specifically LDL cholesterol, high blood pressure, okay, different types of conditions like diabetes, elevated blood sugar, prediabetes. These are the conditions that are not healthy for the artery, and the calcium is coming after the fact. So you're creating the conditions for atherosclerosis, plaque within the artery walls. You're creating those conditions, and the calcification occurs as a consequence of that, and as a consequence of the inflammation caused by the deposition of cholesterol.
To wit, Paul Lemanski, the advice is you can take your calcium pill.
You can take your calcium pill without concern for causing or worsening calcification of your arteries. That said,
you do recommend that.
Well, it depends upon your specific circumstances, but calcium supplements, you know, a few years ago, we were telling people not to take calcium supplements per se, but to get their calcium from food, because there was some data that there was increased risk in cardiovascular risk in women who were taking supplementation, but not in women who were getting their calcium by food. Now it appears that probably was a little bit of an overreaction, but, you know, I would take the recommendation of your physician, and if your physician feels you should be taking calcium, they've obviously done a blood level on you and checked your baseline calcium, and they've taken subsequent levels, and they're the best person to tell you whether it's safe for you to take calcium supplementation.
Karen, okay. Thank you very much. appreciate it. Thank you. Okay, let's go to Jim and Adams. Jim, go.
Yes, good afternoon, doctors. How are we doing?
Good.
Excellent. My question I pose is, why do we never hear of hardening of the veins as opposed to the arteries? In the same blood system, they're all connected.
Well, that's a very good question. And I guess you could also think about, why do they use veins in bypass operations in place of arteries? They're not the same. Why would they do it? And I think the reason why, in the first question, your question, would be that the arteries are a high-pressure system. And, of course, the types of problems that we see, that is atherosclerosis, the types of problems occur as a consequence of the more rigorous pressure that's seen in vessels. And the cholesterol is going to be seen by the vasculature of the arteries much more so than the veins. Remember, by the time something gets to the veins, a lot of the nutrients have already been taken out of it. A lot of the cholesterol has been yanked out of it by other tissues that use that cholesterol. So,
Dr. Bob Barefoot, his sayings on the subject is that, well, people's blood chemistry, primarily in this country, a lot of advanced nations in the world, the type of diet they eat, their blood system, the chemistry is acidic rather than alkaline.
Yeah, I don't know
that
if
that burns
I...
and corrodes the insides of the arteries.
I don't know
and
if
the body starts pulling calcium out to buffer that,
okay.
And deposits calcium.
Okay, Jim.
Yeah. I'd like to make myself heard.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, but it's still my program.
Well, Alan, you have your experts on, and sometimes people have basic knowledge,
but they don't understand. We appreciate your perspective.
You do.
You haven't even heard it yet.
Well, no, he's not done
yet. You're going to be a censor, Alan, or are you going to allow me free speech?
I'm going to allow you free speech for about a minute.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Well, the body buffers the acidic acid blood chemistry with calcium, deposits in the arteries, which are meant to be flexible pumping vessels. And when they start to get too brittle and cracking, the cholesterol goes in and plugs up the cracks. Basically, popular medicine in this country has got it backwards. The calcium appears before the cholesterol. The cholesterol is the glue that saves our lives from the arteries cracking apart and leaking completely.
Okay, your minute's up. No censorship here. Thanks a lot,
Jim.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And, to that end, Al, I think, we draw our cholesterol from the veins, so our blood levels, okay? Yeah. There are different structures dealing with different circumstances in the body. And it's a good question as to why there's no hardening of the veins. But, there are changes that occur in the veins as well as the arteries. And those can be seen when both veins and arteries are put in a similar circumstance as in a bypass, which
right.
is what I was getting at initially.
Your whole point about pressure.
That's right. So when one puts veins in the position of arteries, and the reason why we do that is they're easy to harvest, especially in an emergent situation when we can't dissect out an artery, we find that that atherosclerotic change and damage to that vessel and plugging up of the vein occurs actually much more quickly than it would in an artery. The bypass arteries, typically the internal mammary arteries, last a lot longer than bypassed veins.
Just for the sake of all of us who know, much less than we should, what leads to the heart and what comes from the heart? In other words, the artery goes to?
Typically the artery is coming carrying oxygenated blood.
Yeah.
Okay. And the veins are carrying deoxygenated blood. Okay. So, but there are, if you've got, like your pulmonary artery.
Yep.
It comes from the right side of the heart to the lungs. That's actually carrying deoxygenated blood. So you could say, if it goes away from the heart, it's an artery, and if it goes towards the heart, it's a vein. And generally, you're going to be correct in that regard.
Okay, let's go to Richard in Lanesboro. Okay, Richard, you're on.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking the call. I had a question about eating fiber, and if you eat it first thing in the morning, I've heard that you get a lot of bile that accumulates. And would it be helpful to eat like a high dose of some fiber meal before anything else? And does that function like as a, I don't know if I'm using the right word, a bile sequestrant?
Yeah, well, it doesn't function like a bile sequestrant exactly. High fiber diets, and certain, depending on the type of fiber they are, so a soluble fiber as opposed to an insoluble fiber, can be used to lower cholesterol. When you eat oats in the morning, it's the oat bran in part that, and of course some people eat oat bran cereal, the oat bran, the soluble fiber, will actually decrease cholesterol. You know, other types of fiber, non-soluble fiber, doesn't really have the same effect. So we're really looking, like, for example, Metamucil or psyllium mucilage is a soluble fiber which we can use to reduce cholesterol. The only problem with using fiber in that regard is that many individuals require rather significant reductions in cholesterol, and you really can't achieve truly, you know, significant reductions using fiber. You know, maybe we can get it down, you know, a few, 5 or so milligrams per deciliter, maybe 10, but not the 20, 30, 40, 50 milligrams per deciliter many people require in order to have normalization of their blood cholesterol.
Okay. Very good. Thank you very
Thanks
much.
Thanks a lot. Doctor. Yep. And let's go to Bob in Plainfield. Okay, Bob, you're on.
Hello?
Hello, Bob.
How are you?
Well, pretty good. Don't make good. It worse.
Yeah, that's go good. I'm going to try to make it really brief okay. so that the doctor can use. It's really a question, a societal question, and has to do with exercise and our environment. It seems that the trend, certainly here and probably in all of the West, has been to make things simpler for us, less challenging physically. And just a case in point, I had a conversation with an architect the other day who specializes in developing housing and housing plans for elderly individuals. And he was telling me how they eliminate stairs, which seems pretty obvious, everything on one plane, making things as simple and convenient, as he said, without challenge as possible. So I wanted the doctor's opinion on... So is there a point where those kinds of challenges become a diminishing return into our health as opposed to being advantageous to our health? Thanks.
Well, I think that's for sure. I mean, I think that the human body evolved to handle exercise, to handle physical work. And every time that in the West that we have a labor-saving device, we are taking away from our ability to exercise and burn sufficient calories, both to work off excess caloric intake and to keep, you know, our bodies in optimal functioning. So anything that's, you know, you have to work. There's no easy pathway to health. There has to be individuals need to walk. The easiest and probably best exercise is walking. It's very low risk. You can be as nearly as aerobically trained walking as running if you walk sufficiently. So, yes, I would say you certainly can do things in the construction of a environment which has asks little of you. You certainly, if you ask little of the body, it will give you a little. Will give you little.
Right.
And as a consequence of that, you know, if we all end up allowing labor-saving devices to do everything for us, we will lose the ability to, you know, if you don't lose it, you use it rather, you lose it. And I think that's particularly true in Western culture.
Hence your wonderful remark earlier to the guy who said he had just been out with a chainsaw and you should said you should have been using an axe. Pete Seeger, into his 90s, went out and chopped wood every day.
Right.
It's a lot. You know, and to be fair, you know, using a chainsaw is work. Okay, yeah. It depends on how much wood you're chopping.
How about pulling weeds out of a garden, which I do a lot.
And it can be work as well. Okay, yeah. You know, again, how much are you doing? If you do it for 5 minutes, that's probably not terrific.
How about if you do it for 3 hours?
Yeah, that's quite a bit, actually.
That's me. Okay, Bob, thank you very much. Appreciate
it. Thank you, guys.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Ramon in Montgomery. Ramon, you're on.
Hello, yeah. The the doctor earlier mentioned how the human body developed responding to the environment. That's how it developed. So I just want to know his opinion of the paleo diet.
Well, I think the paleo diet is an oversimplification of a theory that, you know, humans thousands of years ago would eat primarily meat as their source of food. And I think, you know, that that's somewhat of an oversimplification.
I don't know anything about it. That's why I'm asking you.
Well, yeah.
they figure that out by checking the bones?
Well,
you know,
they
could see what the diet was.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you can look at the teeth of a human. And the thing about the, you know, and I'm going to say that I think that, for example, the physiology and the anatomy of humans supports an omnivore as an omnivorous diet as the diet of early humans and not a paleo diet. And, you know, I think that, you know, the paleo diet tends to be very heavy in meat. Meat
and nuts.
Is... Meat
and whatever supposedly they could gather.
Yeah, well, you know, but again, you know, I think that's true, you know, but meat tends to have a disproportion. Perhaps it's the way it's interpreted in the popular media that there seems
to be. Didn't you know everyone was an excellent hunter in the past?
That's right. I mean, anyone who's truly hunted, I think, realizes it's not easy. Mm-hmm. And that's when you have a gun or a bow. I mean, if you were actually right. out hunting with a club
or a rock
or a rock, you know, it becomes much more difficult. In fact, perhaps the reason why humans are as good as we are within terms of verbal ability had to do with the need to communicate so that groups of humans would chase an animal down over many miles and only go in for the kill after the animal was completely exhausted.
Right. I've got a friend that's a nut about it. And we've, you know, I talk. He throws back that they weren't eating big game. They were eating small game.
Okay, listen, Ramon, I can't. I'd love to talk to you longer, but...
Well, thanks for the answer.
Yeah,
you know,
bye-bye.
Al, I think, you know, just to add a little bit more to this, you know, I think that, again, it's a theory. That said, if you go on a paleo diet, right, and your weight improves and your cholesterol numbers improve... I think it's a reasonable thing for you to do if you find that to be a diet that is easy for you to adhere to. So put it to the test. Put it to the test of your blood tests that your doctor will do for you. Put it to the test of your body weight. You could see for yourself. If that diet works for you, then that's the diet you should stay on until you find something superior.
Yep. Okay, so we are out of time. I hate to say it. And we have virtually no time left. I want to thank everyone who called in. Apologize to Jeremy from Carhonkson, who wanted to know about the relationship between weight loss and cholesterol. You got a one sentence there?
Well, it generally doesn't affect LDL cholesterol, the milligram per deciliter, but it will change the size and the way of the LDL particles and the way they're packaged, which does impact health. Larger the particles, the better.
Good. And Bill wanted to know about CoQ10 on statins, the relationship.
It's worth a try. Certainly in people...
Instead of, you mean?
No. While taking statins, people develop myalgia, muscle aches.
I see.
It's worth trying CoQ10 to see if there's anecdotal evidence that that may help.
Okay. And Joan from Albany wanted something, but I can't read it. It says, all numbers are up... at age 62. Okay, well, Joan, the next time we're going to have to discuss that with you. So be sure to call a little bit earlier. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. Always great. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. And a special word of thanks to Dr. Paul Lemansky of the Capital Care Medical Group, the Center for Preventative Medicine, for stepping in when we really needed him. Thank you, Paul. Appreciate it very much. Stay tuned now for a news update.